If you're rocking to get up and it's not a rocking chair, it's time for the Joint Relief Institute. Fast relief, covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
All right, Kim Gordon, Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much for tuning in. Terry Savage is standing by. But, Kim, before we go there, I had a text during the news, and I know Mary Vandeveld had a story, you did as well, about some Illinois economy numbers.
Well, there was a new report that came out that showed that Illinois is number 10. It's one of the hardest states to find full-time work. So Illinois is number 10 when it comes to the toughest states to get a job, with the underemployment rate of 11%, Nevada being number one, and the best place to find a full-time job is South Dakota.
Yeah, but everything else is there, too.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks very much for clarifying that. I appreciate it. Terry Savage is here now to explain exactly why that is. Terry, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hello, Steve. Well, you know, you get what you pay for, and Illinois has some very onerous workers' comp laws. It has an uncertain tax situation, uncertain pension situation for government workers. I don't know if those are included in that statistic. So it's not a surprise that jobs aren't easy to find and that the economy is not growing strongly in Illinois, even though the rest of the country is doing all right. Not great in this economic recovery, but all right. So it doesn't surprise me. I mean, if you're outside of Illinois, and people ask you where you're from, they go, oh, yeah, you've got a problem with this and your governor and the city of Chicago. And people who don't even know anything about economics think Illinois has got a lot of problems. So nobody's locating businesses here.
Well, that's too bad. Now, the JOLTS report came out, and you heard Orion talking about it, the fact that there were more job openings. I think layoffs are near a two-year low. So the jobs market in general looks pretty good. The most recent GDP number, not so good. How are we doing in general?
Well, you know, there's another Labor Department number that came out, and it's a word that only economists use and probably most of our listeners couldn't define or care about very much. And the markets aren't paying much attention, but it sure is impacting the economy. And that word, if you ever took Econ 101, is productivity. The output per worker. When you have a growing economy, you have businesses becoming more efficient, growing and hiring more people. But the Labor Department reported yesterday that productivity fell 0.5% in the second quarter when everybody expected it to have risen almost 0.5%. That, along with rising labor costs, unexpectedly rising labor costs, are really bad news for the growth of the economy.
You've heard
me talk many times that the economy is growing slowly, more slowly than it's a long-term economic recovery, but it doesn't feel like it to a lot of people because the growth is so slow.
Okay.
And now we have this negative productivity.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you a really ill-informed question, so be nice, be gentle to me. But sometimes productivity goes up when the number of workers goes down, right? Because there are fewer workers doing more work. Could the expansion in jobs mean a drop in productivity?
Well, what we're having is an expansion in jobs at higher wages, which, I mean, it may not seem like higher wages to everybody, but I'm looking at the statistics here. Unit labor costs rose 2% for the quarter, well above the 1.5% expected increase. So it means, yep, we're hiring people, we're paying them more, and so the output that we get from them, however, per worker is shrinking. That's really not, I mean, you might think, well, that's okay. At least we got people working
and
they're making more money. But it doesn't lead to economic growth. Not long-term economic growth.
Okay, yeah, right, because that is kind of what I'm thinking, and I'm no expert, but I'm like, well, okay, maybe that's the trade, the yin for yang. If you've got more people working, we kept saying wages need to go up if they're making more money, and the result of that is that your productivity drops a bit, maybe. Can you have both?
You know what? You could have both. You could have both if you change tax policies. I mean, this is a giant economic debate. But you think about this. So you have all these workers, let's say, in Vietnam or Thailand, and instead of getting 22 cents an hour, they get 25 cents an hour, and there's more demand from America for whatever the towels or gym shoes or whatever it is they're making there.
Donald Trump ties.
You have more people. Donald Trump ties. They have more people working, and they are making a little bit more money. But that's not the recipe for real long-term economic growth, is the point. What America needs is to have investment in new technologies. It has to have incentives. And, you know, that gets into tax policy. So what the bottom line is, it doesn't, the water's lukewarm. It's not bubbling over. We're not having a booming economy. We're not worried about that. We're not in a recession, but we're in a kind of a slow growth economy. And what's going on is that people just, they don't feel a whole lot better. They're not so scared anymore of losing their jobs. They think they can find jobs. But again, people are just not feeling great about the economy. It's not a political thing. It's just the way it is.
What leads to how people feel? And the reason I'm asking that is because, you know, if we keep saying things aren't as good as they should, people are going to reflect that, even if they just landed a new job and are making more money. I mean, what is it that leads to that feeling?
People are scared. People are scared. Americans, actually, the consumer, once again, is moving the economy as opposed to industrial production. We're seeing more people saving less. It's a column I'm working on for next week, and putting more debt on the balance sheet. I hope we've learned our lesson. I'm going to write a column that's a reminder. But, you know, as an American, how can you look at our political choices, I mean, on both sides of the aisle, and be really optimistic that we're going to get some good sound policies out of Washington? It's hard to be, it's really, really hard to be optimistic about our future given our political situation.
Okay, so then just to keep that same vein of productivity and compensation and all of that, retail sales, I think, the retail sales comes out on Friday, right, I think?
We'll get those later this week.
Yeah, but we get numbers from Kohl's, Macy's, and Nordstrom all tomorrow. So if we see that increase, would that offset your worry about productivity or no?
No. It just means that consumers are spending their money, some of which is going on credit cards. It's not bad news. Look, as I've often said, it's not your responsibility as a consumer to hold up the entire U.S. economy, but it's a back-to-school shopping season. We'll see how the retailers do. There's a lot of price cutting. There's a lot of discounting. Department stores have had real problems staffing and merchandising in a way to be profitable. And, I mean, everybody's shopping online. A great portion of it's online. I mean, otherwise, why would you have Walmart buying, you know, Jet.com for $3 billion? So the landscape for consumers is changing. I'm not crying doom and gloom, but neither can I say that we're having a boom and that you can expect a better life based on the economy we have now and the outlook for any political change in the next 3 or 4 years.
I want to take a break. You referred to your columns. You've got a great one this week about long-term health insurance and the need for it. It's a little scary, too. But one other thing you mentioned...
Long-term care.
Yeah, you mentioned the back-to-school shopping. There's a great article out there today about how Amazon Prime Day has completely changed that season. You know, because the Prime Day comes up in July, and that's been the biggest shopping day now for back-to-school sales. And the question is how brick-and-mortar are going to catch up with that. All right, I got to take a break, Terry. We'll come back and talk about long-term. I said health care insurance. That's not the right word, is it?
Long-term care.
Right.
If you need help having a shower, getting dressed, I'm going to show you something new, a new way to pay for it.
It's 12:24. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand here. Thanks for listening. I appreciate it. Terry Savage is with us most Wednesdays, and she is this afternoon on a phone line. Now, Terry, I know that because I kept screwing up the reference, it sounded like I didn't read or wasn't concerned, but I do love this column on long-term care. My parents, years ago, got a long-term care insurance policy, which was a great relief to me, and reading what you wrote this week, I realize it's probably time for me to do the same thing.
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of adults to think about doing it for their parents. My dad, and I'm knocking on wood, just turned 95, and I'm sure glad I bought and paid for a policy for him because he uses it. He has someone come in every day now. But the fact is, and that's paid for the long-term care insurance. Most people don't want to think about this. You know, that's my thing. I think about it a lot, and I've spent years trying to get people to buy insurance policies. And, yes, I can hear all of you saying yes, but at the time we bought them, the premium was affordable. And then they raised the premiums. That did happen because the insurers found out just how wrong they had been about projecting the actual usage on the policies they had sold. They'd been using life insurance actuarial tables instead of the right planning. But now I think the costs are probably going to level off, although if you buy a traditional policy, you could wind up paying more as you get older. That is why I just wrote a whole column, it's up at terrysavage.com, about combo insurance policies. Now, look, this is astounding, but the latest cost of care survey by Genworth, a great long-term care insurer, says it now costs on a national average about $3,800 a month for in-home care, but $7,700 a month for a private room in a nursing home. And by the way, that in-home care only covers, if you need someone day and night, it's going to be a lot more than $4,000 a month. But if you were, say, a 55-year-old woman who was going to buy a traditional long-term care policy with 4 years of $4,000 a month benefits with a 3% compound inflation rider 90 days before it kicks in, you'd be paying a little over $3,100 a year in premiums, and those premiums could rise over the years. But now there's a new kind of policy. The details and the prices are in the column at terrysavage.com. But basically, if that same 55-year-old woman had some cash either in her retirement account or saved up, she could buy a combination life long-term care policy. She could put $75,000 into this policy.
Which is a big part of it. I mean, you got to have the cash up front.
Yeah, you have to have cash up front. Or we could do it in 10 payments, by the way, of about $8,700 a year over 10 years, guaranteed not to rise. And that would give her the $4,000 monthly benefit she needs. But if it's not used for care, then her heirs would get a death benefit of $96,000, so more than she deposited.
So if you're hit if you're hit by a bus, your family would get the money that you
get
put
the
in.
Money or something. Back. Exactly. It's not down the drain. So okay, age 55, 4 years of care, $3,100 a year in premiums, which is certainly going to rise over her lifetime in the next 20, 30 years. Or $75,000 invested in a life long-term care policy gives her the same benefit plus a death benefit if she hasn't used the care. And if she doesn't have $75,000 now, she could pay the premium on the combo policy in 10 payments of $8,700. Now, I know I'm talking about a lot of money, but $8,700 is about what you're going to be paying in 20 years, or maybe not even enough to pay for in 20 years, a month in a nursing home.
So this
is the issue. Pay now and be prepared, or, you know, rely on a state Medicaid program, Illinois' Medicaid program, to pay for your care 20 years from now? I don't think so.
Terry refers to her more than him. It's more expensive for her than him because she lives longer, but there are numbers there for guys as well, and it comes cheaper if you do it as a couple. We're out of time, Terry, but I encourage people to read this because it's a great column. It's at terrysavage.com about long-term care insurance. Nice to talk to you, Terry.
Thanks, Steve.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Frank Sennett from Crane Chicago Business is on a phone line. His visits are sponsored by Allstate, and we thank them for that. Frank, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thank you, Steve.
It's good to talk to you. So I was around and hitting the street hard back in the late 80s when the Illinois Sports Facilities Authority was created. Jim Thompson was the governor, and the idea was they needed a way to fund a new stadium to keep the Chicago White Sox in Chicago. They were going to move to St. Petersburg, and I remember covering the legislative session. I think that was the one where Speaker Madigan actually stopped the clock at midnight to give the legislature a little extra time to vote for it. But the idea was then the White Sox got this sweetheart deal for a stadium, and they don't pay a lot of rent. The Sports Facilities Authority needs money, and they're turning more and more now toward outside events like the concert from Chance the Rapper, which is coming up later this summer, right? Is this a sign of a change there?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was some late night drama back in the day for sure. Right now, what we're seeing is there's a thawing in the relationship between the authority and Reinsdorf and the White Sox team. There had been some crunchiness over not wanting to have extra events, concerts, sporting events off season, that kind of thing. And the White Sox were able to veto a lot of that. But now there's a new person, Manny Sanchez, in charge of authority, and he has warmed the relations up. They paid to get a third video board upgrade installed, where they were only going to do two this year and one next year. They got all three in for the White Sox this season, and as a result, at least in part of that, the White Sox agreed to have a Big Chance the Rapper concert, which kind of ties in with the Sox because he's a spokesman for them. They're going to make some revenue off of a big college football game this fall. And so, things seem to be looking up for the Sports Authority and for the state generating some more revenue over what the Sox are paying.
You know, it seems to me that the Sports Authority and the White Sox, it was kind of a shotgun wedding back when it happened. They both short-term got what they needed. But there wasn't sort of a natural communion that would lead to a long-term positive relationship. And, you know, I mean, the Sox, they don't pay much in rent. They've got the authority to, I'm reading Danny Ecker's story here, they can veto special events that come 72 hours before a Sox game or 48 hours after. So they've got a lot of control, which is understandable. They want to keep their baseball field in the best condition possible. But you need some cooperation to make all of this work, and maybe it's about to start happening.
Yeah, that's right. And the White Sox pay about $1.5 million annually. And right now, the authority with these events that they're starting to get approval for, they're budgeting for another $250,000 in revenue from those kind of special events in the current fiscal year. So, you know, it's some incremental growth for them and will help them as the debt payments on the stadium construction continue to go up. They're going to go to $87 million in 2032. So they're trying to bank some money to make sure they have a rainy day fund for when those debts come due.
And a lot of people, there are a lot of people who don't go to U.S. Cellular Field, and I think it was Howard Pizer with the Sox said, hey, if these other events teach people the route and show them how easy it is to get there and that it's nice once you get there, maybe that will help the White Sox as well. Now, I know they're going to have a Northern Illinois football game there this fall. I think, let's see, Bruce Springsteen played there several years ago. Joel Osteen, the minister, had an outdoor event there. I saw you at one of them. I can't remember which one it was.
I don't know, man. Oh, yeah,
it might have been Springsteen.
I could have saw whenever the Braves are in town, for sure.
Well, so let's hope that all of this works because it is a nice place, and it'd be good if it'd be good for everyone if more people went to take in a few White Sox games. Tell me
Especially the concert scene, because Wrigley is a proven concert venue now, and so these promoters are a little reticent. So Chance the Rapper can do well there, then maybe the promoters will take another look at the cell.
Yep. Okay. Tell me about the University of Chicago and what's being called a big gun in the war on cancer. It's not about science. Well, I guess it is about science, but it's not about medical research. It's about computer technology.
Yeah, it's a very cool big data application called the Genomic Data Commons, and it's at the University of Chicago. And basically what it does is it takes profile data from more than 10,000 cancer patients and creates a searchable database. And it's one of the world's biggest collections of such information now, and completely sortable, searchable, shareable in different formats. And so the thought is that not only can this help with some inroads into cancer research, but it could also prove to be a very good setup for, you know, perhaps looking at collaborative research on diseases such as Alzheimer's disease, other diseases.
Joe Biden is, you know, behind the White House Cancer Research Project, and he talked, and many others as well have talked about silos when it comes to research. You know, it's like people sort of keep the information to themselves. They're all contained within their own silos. They could be right next to each other, but the data is not shared. Is this the sort of thing that will help share that data and get around those silos?
Absolutely. I think this is what people are hoping, that it becomes kind of a trendsetter, kind of a model. Right now, the equivalent of 1 million DVDs worth of information, if you want to go back to the red box, motor story.
I've never seen the word in the story. There's the word petabyte. I've never heard 4 petabytes of genetic profile data. That's new to me.
It's more than you're going to keep on that thumb drive on.
That's true. All right. So we'll watch for that and hope that leads to some great things down the road. We're becoming sort of, aren't we, Chicago? We've talked about this before, a data center. The cloud sits on the ground, and more often than not, that ground is in the Chicago area.
Yeah, and they were talking about structurally, you know, we're an intermodal transportation hub, and a lot of those rail lines coming in, a lot of those data lines were laid along the railroad tracks, and so they all converge in Chicago, so there's a lot of data access available here.
Let's
a lot of firepower.
Yeah, and it's a nice sort of area for growth. One other topic I want to bring up with you that I was reading in Cranes has to do with the wings war that seems to be growing in Chicago. I'm not a big wings guy. I don't know that I have been once inside a Buffalo Wild Wings. It doesn't draw me, but it's really growing, and now there's this new company. It's not a new company, but Wing Zone out of Atlanta is starting to increase its presence here in Chicago.
Yeah, you remember 10-plus years ago there was the bagel wars in Chicago?
Yeah, right.
Bagel store. Well, now it's the same, but with wings. Wing Zone is planning to open 35 outlets in the Chicago area by 2020. They're based, as you say, out of Atlanta. And then there are already two big players, Buffalo Wild Wings and Dallas-based Wingstop. And Wingstop wants to more than double its presence to 50 locations. And then Buffalo Wild Wing, with recent openings, give it more than 40 stores in the area. So you're talking a grand total of 125 places dedicated just to serving you wings. If I were a chicken, I would stay out of Chicago.
If you go to one of these, to a wings joint, are you going there to eat, or are you going to a bar that's known for its wings?
Well,
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I think, you know, a lot of people go to these places to watch the game.
On Saturday. So that'd be the bar, sort of. They're going to the bar and having wings while they're there.
Yeah, but I do like wings. They're like some of the most fattening foods you can eat. They're terrible for you, but they taste, to me, amazing. And if you get like a jerk sauce or something, you can really have a fun dining experience.
Well,
Is that enough to sustain 125 of these things in Chicago? I don't know.
I think they're healthier if you dip them in the blue cheese, right? Does that still happen?
That's helpful.
I do like the co-founder Matt Friedman's quoted in this story as far as strategy, you know, because I think they've got a shop in Lombard and Niles now, Wing Zone. They're going to add many more. But he said, you know, we used to go for, right now, he said, we're all about geography. We used to go for probably cheaper spots and figure we could market ourselves into having people go to those out-of-the-way spots for wings. And they said, now we learn that's not quite the case. We're going to be all about location. So they're going to, I think, try to be in Six Corners, Wrigleyville, and other places like that where the crowd already exists.
Right. And that makes a lot of sense. You know, bring the wings where the wing eaters are.
Right.
And there's a lot of them in Wrigleyville, that's for sure.
Right. Rather than have your customers fly to you, I don't know where to go from there.
On a wing and a prayer.
Frank Sennett, nice to talk to you again. We'll hook up next week.
Thanks, Steve.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It is 12:43. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN with a little help from Alice Cooper. Well, at some places, school is never out. You know, we talked earlier about the Wing Zone and how they're moving more stores in. A lot of people are franchise owners when it comes to shops or restaurants. What about schools? I want to talk a little bit about Primrose Schools now with a couple of the schools. Laura and Kurt Daniels are in the studio. Welcome both of you to the Business Lunch.
Thank you.
Well, so do you think of it as a franchise business or an education? Tell me about Primrose Schools.
Oh, well, we're really glad to be here. Kurt and I have been on our Primrose journey for 6 years now. And it's definitely an educational journey.
Yeah, so the schools are in South Elgin and Algonquin, right?
That's correct.
But you're part of a company that franchises out, right? They've got maybe 300 schools around the country?
That's right, in about 25 states.
Okay, and so what is it that drew you to this sort of business?
Well, I had tried to get Laura to open her own child care center for a long time. She was in the corporate child care field, and she never wanted to do it. She felt like she'd be kind of out there on her own.
Right.
And so we started looking at some franchise companies, and Primrose was not in Illinois at the time, but we looked at some of the other ones and found there was a lot of inconsistencies between schools. The schools
were good ones and bad ones.
Only as good as their owners, and there were good and bad ones.
Really? So it wouldn't necessarily be the company, it would be the franchise.
That's correct.
Okay.
So when I asked Laura, who is the best? She said Primrose School, even though there were none in Illinois. So we started looking at Primrose Schools. We visited a lot in Atlanta and some of the other ones in the Midwest that had opened. And we decided that's what we wanted to do.
We just really believed in what Primrose stood for. culturally. It's an organization that embraces service to families, and that's so important when you're working and you have young children.
I read that, Laura. What does that mean, to embrace service?
You know, we serve close to 400 families each week in our two schools. So these, we know as working parents ourselves, when our children were little, it's a partnership. And families are relying on us to make sure that they have peace of mind knowing that their children are doing very, very well. You know, what I like to say is that they're thriving because they're getting a really strong early childhood education.
And the early education is a good deal. I mean, that's something that's important and will pay off for not just the kids, really, but for the communities they live in.
Absolutely. Here, this is an investment that families are making.
Okay, I'm going to ask a crude question because I'm interested in the business of it, the franchise ness of it. You know, when you open a McDonald's franchise, you have to make a burger a certain way. When you open up a Primrose school or one of these schools, how does the development come? I mean, are you restricted by what they tell you to do? Do you have autonomy? Explain that for me a little bit.
It's a good question, and it's complicated. You know, as Kurt mentioned, consistency is important because we want every parent who comes into a Primrose school to have the same experience. And it's interesting because when we opened our first two schools 5 years ago, we had a family that came to us from another Primrose.
Uh-huh.
And they said their little one walked in at JJ and said, "Oh, they moved my Primrose here." So we know it's important. Primrose knows it's important that there's consistency in the way the curriculum is delivered each day to the students.
And it's pretty strict in what they allow you to do.
It is strict. We make sure.
It's not a good or bad.
Certainly it's part of our culture. It's
sure.
To make sure. Now, of course, teachers have to adapt a curriculum to the level of the students' learning. That just makes good sense here. But what goes into a classroom as far as equipment, that needs to be the same
sure.
at each school. You know, how we're involved as owners, that needs to be the same at each school.
All right, the way I was reading this was that Laura was the educator and Kurt was the builder. Is that right, Kurt?
That's true. I've been in construction and remodeling, so I've spent a lot of time remodeling childcare centers before this, and Laura and I worked together closely on a bunch of other projects.
I have this picture of you out there remodeling childcare centers and going home and trying to convince your wife to open one. Is that how it works?
That's pretty much how it works, yes.
It's a huge decision for a family to make, a couple to make, to open a Primrose school. It was the best decision we did make professionally, but it's a huge investment, of course.
What's been the biggest challenge?
Oh, goodness. The biggest challenge is certainly learning how to work with your spouse sometimes every day, of course, and
well,
him to me.
Now,
yes.
Yeah.
The biggest challenge is just having faith that you're doing the right thing. You know, just like any business, it takes time for people to understand what you want to accomplish and what your goals are and to build trust. And we've done that, and we're really proud of our schools.
How do people find more information?
You can go to our Primrose School's website, and it'll take you to the South Elgin School or the Algonquin School.
Laura and Kurt Daniels, thanks for coming in. I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you
Great.
So much.
Thanks for having us.
You bet. It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN.